Edinburgh University with Professor Harunaga Isaacson, and more recently Peter Wan, perhaps the most sought after and respected postdoctorate fellowship at Oxford at All Souls College. We'd also like to thank Peter for hosting us and organising yesterday at All Souls College. It really made the day very very special. So I'll leave it to,
So I think I'm hearing the subtle levels of this nada that we've just experienced. So, yeah, thank you for having me, and thank you for this wonderful conference. Sorry to have missed the first 2 days. We were held captive on this Italian island with Harunaga and Kengo and others, drinking wonderful coffee and other horrible things. So today I'm going to speak about the Amrita Siddhi, giving you a brief introduction. And I must stress that this is not really my paper. It's more of an I'm presenting the results of a joint effort. We've started reading this in Oxford some time ago with Jim and with Alexis and Jason. So there are quite a few things that I'm going to say which are not my findings, but it's results of a group effort. I'm not going to talk so much about the contents of the Amrita Siddhi, this text, what we now call the earliest Hatha Yoga text. I'm going to go into more of the codicological details and that sort of thing, just to get the basic historical evidence right. And then I'm going to propose that there is a text which is transmitted in Tibetan only, which seems to be a precursor of the text that we are reading. So the first published study of the Amrita Siddhi was by a man called Curtis Schaefer of the University of Virginia. This article is called The Attainment of Immortality, From Natas in India to Buddhists in Tibet. It came out 14 years ago. And this is really the starting point for anybody who wishes to engage with this text. Now, a brief note on the handout. I've updated it slightly, so that's the one you should be looking at on the drive. So evidently, this is a pioneering work, and the reason why Schaefer engaged with it was because, although he doesn't mention the name of his supervisor, Leonard van der Kuyp, probably with he wished to remain anonymous, because they obtained a photocopy of a microfilm of a rare manuscript in China, this manuscript that we now call Manuscript C. Which is now probably still at the China Nationalities Library of the Cultural Palace of Nationalities. He wrote a very nice study of this text, starting from the assumption that Buddhists and Natas participated in shared religious practices in India. And he gives us, as I said, a brief introduction. This text is called Amrita Siddhi, or Chimed Dupa in Tibetan. It is authored by a man called Avadhuta Chandra, but I think there are slightly better chances that his name was Madhava Chandra, because that's how he refers to himself within a verse. So that attestation seems to be slightly stronger. The other name we have only in the colophon, if I remember correctly. And this author claims to be probably not a direct student, but a follower of Virupanatha or Virupaksha. A figure rather well known in for students of Tibetan Buddhism. He's a towering figure of an almost mythical status in several Tibetan traditions. Now, the really interesting thing about this manuscript that it is quite unique when it comes to the formatting. It is bilingual. I'm sure many of you have seen this manuscript before. I have given you a couple of snapshots on the handout. It has three registers, basically. The first is gives you the Sanskrit text in a script that Schaefer consistently refers to as Nivari. Then we have the same text transcribed in Uchen, in the headed Tibetan script, just under it. And then we have Curtis would say, the translation added under it. Then he goes on to present the layout and some interesting codicological features. We shall not go into that. Then he briefly studies the colophon, and he said that a person mentioned in the colophon, Ja Bande Pema Özer, that is to say, the monk of the Ja clan, called Pema Özer, was at once scribe, editor, and translator of this text. He also states that because he noticed several inconsistencies between the translation and the Indic text, he made changes as he saw fit. This is Schaeffer relating what the Tibetan colophon is saying. Then Schaeffer goes on to identify this person with Tromlo, who was a junior translator of another very famous translator, a man called Gijo Dawezer, who can be dated, his activity probably falls somewhere in the late 11th century. However, I think Schaeffer knew that he was on shaky ground, and he expresses several hesitations about the dating, composition, compilation. He does say, to be fair, that he's not entirely sure what's going on. Then he mentions that this text is transmitted in other parts of India. He looked up catalogs, and he also did notice that there are testimonia or silent testimonia, what I call incorporations, in later Hatha Yoga texts. Of course, neither list is exhaustive, but he doesn't claim to be exhaustive either. Then he goes on to present the text's career in Tibet, and specifically a cycle of 21 works, which is transmitted only in the Peking canon, so no other transmission has it. He gives you the numbers, which I have given you on the handout. Note that the cycle is transmitted in a rather big block, beginning with 5026 up to 5078, with some intervening works. But there is one work which is separate in the Otani catalog, and this is 3133, and this is the text that we will come back to. Then he goes into some details mentioning some of the towering Tibetan authorities who have studied this text or mentioned it, and of a special note is the mention of Sapan, Satya Pandita, who says that he has studied the text, but unfortunately in this work in which Sapan writes about the Amrita Siddhi, at the end there is a list of texts that he had studied, and some of them are actually of such a type that he doesn't entirely approve of. So we're not entirely certain what's going on, whether Satya Pandita said that, okay, this is a nice text, I've studied it, I've practiced it, or he says, no, this is just one of the texts that I've studied, but I don't approve of it. And then Schaeffer stresses that the view of the practice is to obtain Jiva Mukti, or Sroktar in Tibetan, a nice rare attestation of the term. And in the appendix, he gives a list of the section titles, because the work is in, 26, now I forget, 20? 30,
33.
33 chapters, sorry. Okay. So it's a very good basic study, and Schaeffer would very much like to go into the doctrinal details. Is this a Buddhist text? Is this not a text? How is it syncretic? But I think before we really address that issue, we have to look at some of the basic evidence. One very surprising passage, I must say, is when Schaeffer is musing on the doctrinal validity of the text. So how can you have this text, which obviously has so many Hindu elements, transmitted in a very, very Buddhist environment. And he says, and this, I have given you this quotation, "What sort of reception did the strong presence of religious imagery not normally associated with Buddhism have in Tibet? Apparently, for some, there was no problem with this at all, for in a subcolophon written either by our translator Pema Özer or some other transmitter of the text, the teachings are unequivocally stated to be the words of the Tathagata, the Buddha himself." Now, surprisingly, if you check this note 49 in Schaeffer, the locus that he refers us to in the manuscript contains the following: "Yedarma hetu prabhava hetun teshan tathagato hi avadat, teshan cha yoni roda evan vadi mahashramana." I see some of you chuckling. Well, yes, if you have ever engaged with Buddhist manuscripts, you would know that almost every single Buddhist manuscript has this closing statement. It's a kind of a Buddhist credo. So, as Ivan Carr said, maybe we should read on and maybe we'll have fewer great ideas. And then he goes on, he says, perhaps, however, we can read this as a seal of approval, attesting more to the practice's perceived liberative efficacy than its doctrinal or sectarian affiliations, and on and on. But basically, this idea can be disproved, I think. So how did our joint work start? I think Jim started a draft edition some time ago from other manuscripts of the Amrita Siddhi. Before obtaining the copy I just mentioned, and I will consistently refer to this as manuscript C. And as I said, this was read in Oxford with Alexis Sanderson, Jason Birch, and many others. It then became a rather essential part of the present project, and we have continued reading in Oxford, also trying to check the Tibetan where it is legible, i.e. the Tibetan translation. Now, if you have a brief look to the folio, the Tibetan translation is giving in cursive, in Ume, and unfortunately the copy is not very good. So I've really strained my eyes trying to find out what's going on. Sometimes it is legible. You can make out some of the passages. It's fine. Then Jim very generously offered that we jointly edit this text, and he had also published a very nice draft paper on Academia Edu, highlighting our, I think, so far chief discovery concerning this text, namely that it is much more Buddhist than we initially supposed. Now, when we started this project, we said that this is the earliest Hatha Yoga text. Why do we say that? Because this text has a colophon containing a date. And the date seems to be, while Curtis converted it to 1159, I think now we can be a little bit more precise, 1160. That's not a big deal. And the date is given in this verse towards the end of the manuscript. You also have the folio to check. Ekashiti jute shake, I've given you a diplomatic transcript. Sahasreke tu pagune krishtashtamyam samapteyam, I think it's samapteyam, not samaptoyam, kritvamritas siddhirmaya. You can immediately see that this is rather problematic. So he says, in the Shaka year, 1000 joined, jute is just scribal dialect for yute, joined with 81. In the month of Paguna, on the 8th of the dark half, it has been completed. The Amrita Siddhi Samapta has been completed. And then this Kritva and Maya are very obscure. Not entirely sure. Well, not entirely sure is an understatement. I'm absolutely puzzled how to construe this. But anyhow, I will go back to that issue. The main thing is that we have a date. And we took this to be the date of the manuscript itself. And I think we were wrong. So this is so it's not entirely certain that this is the date of the manuscript. My first suspicion was when I was trying to make out the material of the manuscript. The photos are not very good, but I've shown it to several experts, and this very much seems like paper. Now, if it is paper, then I think this would make it, I'm looking at Camillo, he's not here. This might make it the earliest paper manuscript on the subcontinent. No?
It's supposed to be Dwanya Loka, which is 1100.
Oh, yeah?
I've never seen it.
Is it in the Nepal one or where is it
coming? No, it's in Gujarat.
Okay.
Camillo mentioned yesterday something like 6th century paper manuscript.
Well, yes, but that's a very different environment. We're talking about the subcontinent now. Okay, so please keep that thought in mind. Anyway, I think it's not typical to have paper manuscripts in Eastern India in the mid-12th century. But there is absolutely no reason to assume that this is an early paper manuscript. I think the solution is that the producer of manuscript C simply had an Indian manuscript, be that Nepalese or Eastern Indian or whatever, which he copied over into this document very, very faithfully. And a rather telltale sign is that the scribe seems to have difficulty with vowel quantity. Although, of course, this is not unheard of with Indian scribes. the sheer amount of occurrences, to me at least, very strongly suggests that a Tibetan is at work. So therefore, the date 1160 still holds, but if I am right, this is only virtual evidence. Also note that because of the ambivalent phrasing and because what follows reads iti amrita siddhi samapta, so it says this is the end of the work, this is where the amrita siddhi ends. Now normally a scribal colophon would come after this. Moreover, it's not at all clear whose verse this is. So does the author tell us in very bad Sanskrit, kritva maya, does he mean kritir me? This, my work, the amrita siddhi, has been completed. In that case, we have an authorship date, i.e. Avatuta or Madhava Chandra is telling us that he has completed this work in 1160. Or is this an ergative construction, which is a typical feature of, Nevar, but also of Tibetan? That is to say, when you have a transitive verb, you will put the logical subject in the instrumental. And then we have to amend to krita instead of kritva. But that still sounds very odd. But at any rate, I think it's fairly clear that the manuscript itself is not from 1160. Okay, now the second piece of codicological detail, the Nevari script. What can we say about this? We also accepted this as a given and said, okay, this is a Nepalese manuscript. But then, and this was an elephant in the room moment for me, there is absolutely no reason whatsoever to do so. So this type of script is seen elsewhere in Eastern India. And don't let the occasional hooked-ups fool you. I think Bendall was incorrect in positing that theory, because the evidence for similar features being employed outside Nepal, even the Shirorekha type A, is, I think, mounting quickly. So we need to revisit that bibliographic doctrine very quickly. In fact, the evidence to the contrary, that this is not Nepalese, is somewhat stronger. The use of the Prishtamatra is rather overwhelming, which is not to say that the Nepalese do not use it. The style of dating, the Shaka year, is also somewhat suspicious. Again, this is not to say that the Nepalese are ignorant of it. But then where do we go? Well, an obvious place, because of other features, not distinguishing Ba and Va, confusing Ya and Ja, we probably want to look at East India. So the first thing we would say, okay, maybe this is the copy that the scribe, the producer of manuscript C, had in front of him was a Pala production. But then, about 2 days ago, the realization hit me that the Palas don't use Shaka dating either, at least not that I'm aware of. They use regnal dates, or very rarely Vikrama. I think there is a Mahipala inscription, the earliest to use the Vikrama date in the Pala domain. This is the Sarnath inscription from 1083, recording a restoration. But otherwise, they use regnal years, and I don't think I've ever seen Shaka. I may have to check this more, but I just simply can't recall anything. And also note that 1160 is more or less the date of the fall of the Palas and the starting point of Sena dominance in Eastern India. So we might want to think, okay, this is a very speculative idea. Could this have implications concerning patronage? Right. Then I revisited the Tibetan colophon, about which, remember, Schaefer said that the scribe, the Tibetan scribe, identifies himself as a Jaobande Pema Özer, and he says that this man, Pema Özer, is at once scribe, editor, and translator. Now, unfortunately, the Tibetan says no such thing. Here, you can see the Tibetan colophon on page 4 of the handout. You can see that there is a bit in Uchen, and there are slight... there are some interlinear notes or whatever they are in Ume. Now, these are quite illegible. But if you read the Uchen, he says, okay, this is very odd Tibetan, but I think I know what he means. He says, okay, this is the end of the Amrita Siddhi. And then he says, the entire text, Tadek Payashung, Yape Jiltabashin Lüdyurne, I have Lügyur means something like rupantaritam in Sanskrit. So I have transcribed. It's an interesting codicological expression. Does he mean I have transcribed faithfully? I've taken the shape of the letter and just transferred it into the Tibetan. And then, Lotsava Jande Javande Pema Özer Gi Jiltar Gyurva Shin Chintapte Tekar Drangpao. Now, if you understand this statement, it means that the actual name of the scribe falls into the oblivion of anonymity. What the man is saying here is that he had taken an earlier Tibetan translation of Pema Özer and he added it in an interlinear fashion into the manuscript. So this guy, Pema Özer, is definitely not at once scribe, editor, and translator. He's a translator at most. And this is very evident when the Tibetan is legible. When we compare the two registers of the Sanskrit and the Tibetan, it is quite clear that the Tibetan translation is based on a different recension of the Sanskrit. So this is not a translator's workshop manuscript, looking at the Tibetan and looking at the Sanskrit and translating it into Tibetan. There was a scribe who had a Sanskrit manuscript, which he then transcribed faithfully, then added a Tibetan transcription, and then added an earlier translation that he had lying around somewhere. Interestingly, some of what this Tibetan translation has is sometimes attested in other transmissions of the Amrita Siddhi, even the Gujarati or the South Indian recensions.
17th, 18th.
Yeah, and this was quite a surprise. So the recension history complications come very, very early, in other words. Then, okay, we've been through that. He says that he copied over the Sanskrit faithfully, and he also says, note that Schaeffer said that he tinkered with the text, making it better. He also, but what he actually says that he did not correct them, did not correct the text. In fact, the very opposite. He claims that he could not improve on the text. He says it is very difficult for a person like me to Sanskrit, to embellish, to emend the text. And I'm not sure I understand the reason completely. He says képe döngyi gyűrve. It is because the wise, whoever that is, translated it according to the meaning. That was a very literal translation, or I'm not sure what he means by that. Yeah?
Sanskrit Arthanuvada, which means paraphrase rather than Shabdanuvada.
Aha, okay. Okay. I think we're slightly unfamiliar with these translators' technical terms. Yeah. So, Lügyur, I've never seen Lügyur before. To transfer a body, i.e. to take a shape, and anyway. So I think that revises Schaeffer's statements, and we may have a clearer picture of how this manuscript was produced. It was obviously produced by a Tibetan. His name is anonymous. He did have a Sanskrit manuscript, which is not necessarily Nepalese. In fact, I think it comes from the Sena domain in Eastern India. And then he transliterated into Tibetan for reasons, well, maybe to make it easier for the reader. And then he added a translation that he had available. And this more or less solves the gap. If we identify Javande with Tromlø, who was active in the late 11th century, then that explains this gap of 60 years. Well, maybe not, but anyhow. The next point I want to get to is more or less a short presentation of what Jim has written up a couple of months ago. So it was fairly clear to us that there was some kind of syncretism going on, but now we have evidence, I think, that the primary audience consisted of, for the most part, esoteric Buddhists. To start with some suspiciously Buddhist terms, we have Mahamudra, Vajra Panjara, but strangely not the text, but meaning the body, I believe. Then we have Shunyata, Abhisheka, okay, that is sometimes used by other schools as well, and Buddha. Okay, mentioning the Buddha is no big surprise. But there are some very, very strongly Buddhist terms, doctrinally speaking. Jnana Sambhara, for example, is a very heavily loaded Mahayana term. It means the two, one of the two equipments that the Bodhisattva has to gather during his career, the other being punya, merit. And then we have the mention gotra, and we can only make sense of this word gotra if we take it in the Mahayana Sutra Alankara meaning. This potential to become Buddha. Then we have kutagara, which I don't think we see anywhere else, only in Buddhist literature, meaning the central pointy palace in the mandala. And then we have trivajra, the triple vajra of body, speech, and mind, which is very strongly associated with early tantric Buddhism, for example, Guhya Samaja. And we have mention of the trikaya doctrine, the triple body doctrine. And also, we have a list of blisses of the four anandas from the Hevajra Tantra. And these occupy chief positions in the text. We also have words which are spelt in the Buddhist style. As Alexis has shown earlier, the spelling Chandoha for Sandoha, this is one kind of pita, a kind of pilgrimage place, can be seen only in Buddhist text. But then what really made me sit up was one particular verse that I think Jim will read in a minute. And this verse mentions Svadhisthana Yoga. And I looked around the room when we came to this verse and I said, does this mean anything to you, yogis? Is this term in any way familiar to you? And everyone said no. For me, it's very clear what Svadhisthana Yoga means. It's essentially deity yoga in the esoteric Buddhist terminology. It's empowering yourself, empowering the constituents of your body as the deities of the mandala. And he says that our author, Madhava Chandra, says in verse 8.9 that this is a useless practice for perfecting the mind. He says it's like chewing stone. It's like drinking air. You're not going to get anything out of it. And instead of Svadhisthana Yoga, one should use the following practice after having obtained it from a guru. And then he proceeds to describe the central tenets of the text, the central practice of the text, which will be the topic of James' talk. In other words, he's singling out what is essentially deity yoga, using a very strongly Guhya Samaja or Shambhara related term. And then my question is, why voice this so strongly if your intended audience is not tantric Buddhist? Especially just before you are about to introduce the central practice of your school. Now, also interesting to note that although not consistently, the other transmissions, i.e. the ones in Western India, in South India, and in Nepal, although the South Indian recension is surprisingly conservative, seek to erase or replace these Buddhist terms. In other words, we're essentially looking at what Alexis has identified in the Chakrasambhara the other way around. So removing Shaiva terms and putting in Buddhist terms. Here we have the Buddhist terms kicked out and replaced with sort of neutral, not Shaiva, but more neutral Hindu words. I don't think this was always conscious, but several times you can see that if you're going to go for that reading, the verse just doesn't make any sense. One such example is the opening verse, which is a eulogy of the goddess Chinnamasta. This is there in manuscript C, and it's not there in the West, in the Western transmission, not there in the Nepalese, but it is transmitted in the Granta manuscripts we have, but in a garbled form. So I think they call Chinnamasta Chittasta or something like that. Yeah, and then they mess up the meter, and so it's... So anyhow, removing this Mangala verse is one very important editorial intervention. And I think both Gundrun Bühnemann and Alexis Anderson would agree, as they have shown, that she is a Buddhist goddess to begin with, and was then incorporated in the Eastern Indian Shakta pantheon. Interestingly, we have independent evidence for in Sanskrit for Virupa's connection with this goddess. And this I found in one of these Prakirna Patras in the Kaiser Library, number 139. This is a collection of leaves from various places, 35 palm leaves. And two leaves contain an almost complete Chinnamunda Sadhana, which can be found in the Tibetan in the Tibetan canon, number 1555 in the Derge print, where it is attributed to Virupa. Now, unfortunately, the Sanskrit does not give us the name Virupa, but I think we can be fairly certain that. Well, there is no strong evidence, but anyhow, we seem to have independent corroboration that this Virupa that we are talking about was somehow connected with Chinnamasta. Maybe it was his Ishtadevata. But the only thing we can really gather from this text is that the author, maybe Virupa himself, is an Eastern Indian, because he has a nice Mantrodhara section which very, very clearly raises, instead of Vajra Vai Rocha Niye, Bajra Bai Rocha Niye. So, Vangadeshe Abeda. There is no distinction between Va and Ba, not even if you're reciting a mantra. And I have given you the slightly idiosyncratically written section, Mantrodhara section. So you take the 23rd, then you take the third from counting from the letter cha, then you link below the 27th, and then it's a very easy Mantrodhara once you know how to go on about it. Then take the letter paprishtam, i.e. the one coming after the letter pa, then link it together with the 12th vowel, which is ai. Then take the seventh counting from the letter pa, which is ra, and so on and so on. So we very clearly get bojro bojro chaniye instead of vajra vajro chaniye. So I think that makes it fairly clear that the author is an East Indian. Okay, now for the last part, I would like to talk about a text which is transmitted, as I said, only in the Peking canon. This is Otani catalog number 3133. Remember, the rest of the Amrita Siddhi texts are in a block separately under numbers 5000 something, and this is separate. The title is given as Amrita Siddhi Mula, the root Amrita Siddhi or something like that, but I don't think we can trust these Tibetan canonical titles too much. The colophon attributes it to Virupa. This text it says is authored by Virupa, and we have some independent evidence for that as well within the text. It also starts with an obeisance to Chinnamasta, but this verse is not parallel to the one that we have in manuscript C. Now, what the text is a very, very short description of the three crucial practices, the three basic practices of this teaching, of the Amrita Siddhi teaching, again, the topic of James' talk. And these are three. Don't worry about what these are. We will find out in a moment. The Mahamudra, the Mahabandha, and the Mahaveda. And you have to combine these three practices, and then you obtain immortality. So this is only what the text teaches, the three basic practices. It starts really in the middle of things. He says, I am going to teach the Mahamudra. Then he says, I'm going to teach the Mahabandha, and then I will teach the Mahaveda. And then we have... Okay, the Tibetan translation is, to be very generous to the translator, mediocre. But if you know what he's talking about, and if you look at Madhavachandra's Sanskrit, then you can make out that these verses are paralleled in Madhavachandra quite precisely. So you have 11.1-7 in Madhavachandra's text is transmitted here too, then 13.1-6. Then there is an intervening verse, the authorship statement, which I will examine just below. And go on. So I'm on. So I'm not going to read out numbers, but it's very clear that there is a relationship between the two texts. It's probably the same text. We're not entirely sure because the Tibetan translation garbles it. If you're unfamiliar with Tibetan Trantic translations, well, imagine something like Google Translate for Japanese. You take a Japanese text or something that Google Translate is not quite adequate for. So you can sort of make out what the statement is about, but when it comes to the finer details, it leaves a lot to be desired. Now let me go back to this authorship statement. As I said, we have independent evidence. It's not only the colophon that says that this is the work of Virupa. The author himself says that I am Virupa. He says, since wind pervades everything, it is wind that bestows all supernatural accomplishments. It is due to wind that one becomes immortal. This, I, Virupa, have explained in the Amrita Siddhi. I think that's the most natural explanation of the Tibetan. He says, Deni, this, this will be a subject marker. Dutsi Drupar Ni, Virva Gai Yandakshe. This I have explained clearly in the Amrita Siddhi. But he is writing something called the Amrita Siddhi. So then my question is, maybe we have to amend Drupa to Dupa, and then we have something like a nominative noun, and then we have to understand, I, Virupa, have taught this work, the Amrita Siddhi. But then we have a problem. Why is this verse in the middle of the text? This sounds like a final verse. Or maybe we have to take it in a very weak sense. This I have taught, this teaching, for the sake of attaining immortality, or qua the attaining of immortality. I'm not entirely sure what he means. So there are various interpretations that we can play around with. But for me, the essential bit was that the author refers to himself. So here we seem to have a text related to the Amrita Siddhi corpus, written by Virupa, giving the basic practices. Now, I think that unless we have contrary evidence, this must be the proto-Amrita Siddhi, i.e. a text which is even older than Madhavachandra's. And just to conclude, I want to give you an example of how this proto-Amrita Siddhi can be studied. So in the Tibetan, beginning with Sani Vyume Sukchen Te, we obviously have what is transmitted in Madhavachandra's Amrita Siddhi as 13.3. So I will translate that first. Trigger warning, misogynistic text. Gunarupa vati nari nishpala purusham vina mahamudra mahabando vina bedena nishpalo. Okay, no points for composition, but I think we understand what he means. So just like a woman, although she may be endowed with qualities and she might be beautiful, she is fruitless, probably barren, cannot give child to, without a man. In the same way, the two practices that I have just taught, the Mahamudra and the Mahabandha, without the Veda, understand the Mahaveda, which is the Mahaveda, are fruitless, Nishpalo. Now, if you go to the Tibetan, you can see that Pada A is somehow garbled. Tsa should mean Nardi, the tube. So maybe the Tibetan translator read Nardi instead of Nari. And then we have something mirroring woman, but then we lose Nari. And then we have Sukchen, which is Rupavati. So Guna is somehow lost in translation, as they say. And then if you only had the Tibetan without access to Madhavachandra, you would read something like, the great mudra spreads, the great binding, okay? Now I think we have to read Dang instead of Dar. So the great mudra and the great bandha, yeva mena, if there is no Veda, if there is no Bheda, if there is no Mahaveda, is fruitless. So he almost got that one wrong. So I think this is the way to go on studying this text, only with a reference to Madhavachandra. But I think that there is a very strong possibility that this text, transmitted only in Tibetan, is our newest, earliest Hatha Yoga text. I think that's all I have to say to you. Sorry.
15 minutes for questions, discussions.